there seems to be an elephant in the room about whether or not they actually got notice. I saw some talk about, well, you sent it to husband and wife, and you were supposed to send it to husband and to wife, not both. But then in your brief, I didn't see where that was responded to at all. Y'all just went off on the fact that we don't have to notify anybody because that's not what it says, which is a pretty tough position to take.
I understand.
So were they notified? I mean, that's kind of the elephant in the room to me. Were they notified? Did they get something, the rest of both of them?
They were notified in accordance with the statute, which requires the court. And I asked, I handed out just a comparison of these two notice provisions. And if I could point you to that, I think I can explain. Okay. Condemnation, as you know, is a two-part process, right? We go through the commissioner's hearing, and there's a very specific provision requiring notice of the commissioner's hearing, right? And that provision starts out that each party is entitled to written notice. So for the commissioner's hearing, the initial administrative piece, yes, each party is entitled to receive notice. Obviously they're entitled to receive it. It's not just that it has to be sent. If you go on down to provision C, the notice has to be returned before the hearing can be held. The server has to write a return of service on the notice that states how and when it was served. The legislature was very specific, very explicit. Each party has to receive notice of the commissioner's hearing. And the cases hold that satisfies due process. So we go through the notice, we have the hearing, the commissioners file the award, and we get to the second piece. And that piece is governed by 21.049. And if you'll notice the difference between those provisions, I mean, here again, the courts have held that the first piece satisfies due process, so the stakes aren't as high because the parties have already received due process. But if you'll look down to that.
Or the hearing.
Or the hearing, right.
For the hearing.
Right, and the court sees it as one whole process. And again, due process requires notice and a meaningful opportunity for a hearing at some point in the process. That's already been satisfied. Here, the clerk shall send notice by certified or registered United States mail return receipt requested or to the parties in the proceeding, not to each party, at their addresses of record. And the clerk did that. And there's no dispute in the record that each part of this provision was satisfied. Now, the C's argue that you should read a receipt requirement into this. But to do that, you have to read it into this provision.
What if they received it too late? What if on its face? There's a time period that begins with the decision making.
Right? Right.
What if the green card shows on its face they got it after it's too late? Would you just say, oh, that's too bad. We did what we were supposed to do.
I think under the statute, that's the way it's written.
Can't possibly be due process.
Well, but the due process has already been satisfied.
The hearing.
Right. Right, and they had the opportunity to show up at the hearing and argue. They know the award's got to be filed the day or the next day.
Or whenever they get to it, yes.
Right, but in this case, and there's a good point in the brief raised, and I want to mention that, that we didn't know that it would be filed that day. And I've got two answers to that. One, you should have shown up and you would have known. But also, the party knows that the attorney for the condemnor is going to show up and say how much the damages ought to be. They're not going to show up and provide any other evidence. Is it really reasonable for the attorney to say, oh, this is going to be a long, complicated process and it might take them weeks to come up with a decision? It doesn't work that way. So I'm not sure that has a lot of credibility. I think, though, in your case, that might be another case. That's not the case here. We know that it was sent. We know that it was returned to Michael. Michael Say says, and that's the other thing here. We don't have a factual record. The C's make a lot of it's undisputed that there was no notice. This record doesn't support that. What this record says is Michael Say says, I did not receive a notice. I did not ignore a notice. My wife also went to the post office sometimes. There's no testimony in this record as far as what Mrs. C may have done. She may have ignored a notice. We don't know. She may have received a notice. We don't know. So we don't have the factual record to get to there was no notice anyway. And I think that's a significant point here.
Did I make it up? I mean, did I dream that they were talking about notice to both of them and not notice to one of them?
Your Honor, if it's in the record, Mr. C's affidavit is at clerk's record 105. And then the part of the transcript is the reporter's record at page 12.
Maybe I just...
I saw that too.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
It's pretty carefully stated.
Judge Gardner indicated I wasn't reading.
Oh, you aren't?
Okay, good. All right, that's fine. I just thought it was curious. I thought that from reading their brief, that's where they were going. You had to send it to us individually, not together. And then when I read your brief...
Right, and my response to that was, if you didn't have to receive it at all, it really doesn't matter if either one of them has to receive it. So I did kind of slide through that. But, yeah, if you look at Michael C.'s affidavit and then at the transcript, there's no testimony that he didn't know, for one thing. He said he didn't receive a notice. But that's like the tax cases. You know, if you know, when you get to due process, you're not talking about a statutory violation. You're talking about just notice of some kind. So him saying, I didn't receive a notice, is not the same thing as saying, I didn't have notice. And then again, we have no testimony from Mrs. C. So I think that's important. The one other issue that I'd like to speak with the court about is the proper remedy here. And we did file a motion to dismiss, and that's based on Pearson and some of the other cases that hold just without question that if objections are not timely filed, the administrative part of the proceeding never becomes judicial. The court has no jurisdiction as a judicial body. The only thing that the court can do is enter the award as the quote-unquote judgment of the court. It's not really a judgment. It's an administrative order, again, under Pearson. And the only jurisdiction the court has in is in its administrative capacity to enter that judgment on the award. No, it never requires judicial jurisdiction. And because of that, if the trial court doesn't have jurisdiction, this court doesn't either. And so we think the proper remedy here is to dismiss for want of jurisdiction. Now, obviously, alternatively, if the court is not inclined to dismiss, we'd ask the court to affirm. Looking back to the language of the statute, the argument made sort of in response to our argument under 21.049 is that it does not require receipt is citing to this John versus State case. And in that case, we got almost to the same place. They got notice of the commissioner's hearing. The commissioners held the hearing. They filed the award. But the clerk did not send the notice. And when the clerk did not send the notice, the court held that the time period to file was told until the clerk sent the notice. And the C's argument goes something like, well, it's the same result. You know, there the clerk didn't send it, so the court held that the time period was told. Here we didn't receive it, so the time period should be told. And there's two important differences. First, in John, again, the issue is whether the clerk sent the notice. And if you look at 21.049, it specifically requires the clerk to send the notice. So John versus States is right. I mean, if the court does not comply, the clerk does not comply with the statute, that definitely tolls the time period, but that's not the case we have here. There's no dispute in this case that Barnett Gathering and the clerk did everything they should have done under the statute. There's nothing that is blatantly, you should have done that and you didn't. A holding in this case that due process was not satisfied is a holding that this statute is unconstitutional because there's no argument that the statute was not complied with, as there was in John. And I also like to point the court to the PR Investments case, and the Brown case that are cited in the brief. And both of these are 2008 Texas Supreme Court cases where the courts had sort of the same question that's before this court, and I like to call it the functional equivalent analysis. And it goes something like this. If the statute says A, and B is really sort of the same thing, but it's not A, then the statute must admit B too. And in PRI, the issue was the condominor put forth two separate proposals for a construction project, one of which had much more collateral damage to the remaining property of the landowner. And that was the plan that went before the commissioners. That's what the award was set on. And they proceeded to trial, went through the jurisdictional requisites were satisfied. And they got to trial, and the condominor said, oh, wait a minute, we want to go with the other plan. And what it did was basically destroy the condominee's damage model. So all of a sudden, the best recovery they could get was a very small fraction of what they had been seeking. And, you know, they complained, said, you can't do that. And the court said, no, you can't do that. You've got to go through on the plan you submitted you know, we're not going to do that to these condemnees. And the Supreme Court reversed and said, wait a minute, the statute does not say that the condemnor cannot make those changes. If the condemnor decides it needs less property or is going to do less damage, this is a good thing. The statute doesn't say you can't do it. You can't do that. And it cites back to the old Simmons case, the miners, taking the miners' property to satisfy court costs. And it says, you know, courts should take statutes as they find them. And that piece is about a 100-year-old case, and it's cited in probably hundreds of cases since then, that particular provision. Then also in Brown, the issue was attorney's fees. It's kind of the same sort of setup. They got to court, and the condemnor eventually dropped everything except a very small piece. And the court said, well, that's functionally a dismissal of the case. And under the statute, if the condemnor dismisses the case, they have to pay the other party's costs. And so the court awarded attorney's fees and costs. And the Supreme Court said, no, it's not a dismissal. The statute says if the case is dismissed, you get fees. The case was not dismissed. You don't get fees. And in both of these cases, the Supreme Court, I think, is doing two things. One, reiterating that the court's role is to enforce and to interpret a statute, but not to make the law. And second, I lost my train of thought. I'm sorry. And second, to recognize the role of the courts in this proceeding. Courts have no general jurisdiction over eminent domain proceedings. The only jurisdiction the court has is what arises under the statute. And because of that, it's that much more important, more significant, that the courts work within the statute and not with what they think the statute ought to say. And again, I'd like to re-urge the motion to dismiss under Pearson. The language in there says it's an inescapable conclusion because the objections were not timely filed. The court had no jurisdiction. The trial court had no jurisdiction. We don't have an appealable judgment. The Court of Appeals doesn't have jurisdiction either. And then I think the final point is the C's have a remedy here. I mean, I know Justice McCoy, and it is. It seems harsh to say, oh, you didn't get notice, you don't get to proceed. But what the C's got and what they will continue to have is their remedy at law. They had three disinterested people, landholders in Tarrant County, sit down, look at their property, look at all the appraisals, look at all the information that was in front of them. They had the opportunity to put additional information in front of them, which here they didn't take. And those three people swore to fairly, impartially, and according to the law, value that property. And they did that. And that money is sitting in the registry of the court. So to dismiss this case or to affirm the trial court's judgment is not to leave them without a remedy. It's to leave them with the remedy as provided by law. Okay. I'm going to give you some time back unless you've got some questions.
Any questions?
No.
Bye. Questions? No questions. Thank you very much, Ms. Manning. Appreciate your argument. And your case is submitted. Thank you. We are going to take a short break for a panel change. So the court will stand in recess for 10 minutes. Thank you very much.
All right.